Do you remember the first time you ever got to see a president? Or do you remember the first time you ever got to see somebody important or somebody famous? Do you remember what the entourage was like? I remember when we lived in Champaign, Illinois, we went and we got to see President Clinton. I remember with President George Bush Jr. He came here to a city south of the town. And I was riding along with Steve Bailey, one of our highway patrolmen at the time. And we were in this squad, and it was very interesting to see how this thing did. First of all, he landed at the airport, but he landed at a special place and went into Randy's fire station. Randy is one of the fire chiefs of the airport out here. And so Randy took me on a tour, and they've got a special room in this fire station where just the president can go into, and he has got communication ability just like that anywhere, and it's secure communication. He can launch missiles from there. Oh, I got to see all that stuff, and so we could listen on the radios. We were out in the middle of this divided highway, and we were right in the middle, pointed one direction, and they said, he's going to be coming down this way. Steve says, now let me tell you what you're going to see. He says, first of all, they're closing down the freeway right now. And they were indeed. They had squads timed to block off all the entrances. Then he says, you're going to see a couple of sweep cars go through. There will be two of these highway patrol cars on each lane, got their lights going, and they've got a big Suburban behind them. And they're sweeping through. And if there's anything that's amiss, it'll be taken care of. For instance, he said, just heard on the radio, he said, there's a car off on the side of the road, broken down. He said, you'll see the tow trucks come by. And as he said it, there they went. And they were going down after the sweep cars. And that vehicle was towed. It was completely gone. Then he said, you'll hear more chatter on the radio. And then you'll see a couple of these SUVs, they come down first. And after they come down, then you will see the beginning of the president's convoy. And it will be several SUVs, black SUVs. Then there will be a couple of these great big limos. They call them the Beast. There will be a couple, and you won't know which one the president's in. And then there will be also vehicles behind him. And he says, they not only will block off the entrance ramp so that people cannot get on, but they will block off the exit ramp so some criminal won't try to drive through there and T-bone him. He says, there are going to be people like us. We're in this cruiser right here. And I said, what do we do? He said, well, we do anything that they need. But he says, we're the last line of defense. I said, what do you mean? He says, if somebody comes down here with a big old truck, a big old dump truck filled with explosives, or a semi full of such and such, and we can't stop them, he says, it's our job to ram it, and if need be, give our lives to save the president. And I'm going, oh, I just thought this was a regular ride-along today. I didn't know I might see the president and then Jesus, or see Jesus first and miss the president altogether. But it was just like he said. It was amazing sitting there, seeing all this thing happen, hearing the chatter on the radio. There were all kinds of things in the air that we didn't know about, but you could hear a helicopter, all kinds of interesting things, because a very important person was coming. The biggest crowd I think I ever saw was when the Pope came to Des Moines, Iowa, and he landed in one of those big Sikorsky helicopters, the Sea Stallion helicopters that are used. 400,000 people, they estimated, were filling the hills for acres and acres and acres. Well, this is the kind of thing that we expect when society's key leaders will happen to come. And this is the kind of thing that one would expect when a king or a ruler came to power. Well, today we're looking at some scriptures from St. Luke's Gospel, also St. John's Gospel, that deal with the coming of Jesus into Jerusalem just before his final Passover, just before he goes to the cross. Luke chapter 19, verse 28. Jesus went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. Remember, no matter where he comes from, when you go to Jerusalem, if you're going to Jerusalem, you're going uphill. Like Rome, it sits on seven hills. So you're always going up to Jerusalem. As he approached the hill called the Mount of Olives, and this is an incredible hill that you stand on. This is the one that he'll come down and touch down on later on, and it will have an earthquake, and a river will flow through there. But you can stand on the Mount of Olives today and look across and see the Temple Mount, the very mount where the Temple of the Jews stood, although the Al-Aqsa Mosque stands there and also the Dome of the Rock stands there now. He's standing on this hill looking over, and he sends two of his disciples into this little village right over here. He sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go into that village. As you enter it, you'll find a colt that's tied up there. One of the other gospels says you'll find a mother and the colt, two of them. And he says, bring them, untie them and bring them. He says, now, if anybody says to you, why are you untying it? Tell him the Lord needs it. Now, those who were sent ahead went and they found it just like he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owner came out and says, what are you doing? They said, the Lord needs it. So they brought it to Jesus and threw their cloaks on the colt and put Jesus on top of it. Now, this is very interesting. It's a colt that has never been ridden before. The fact that it's there with the mother tells you that it is still attached. It's still probably barely even weaned. The idea is that they bring the mother along and the colt will follow. That's how they get the colt to do what it's supposed to do rather than what it wants to do. But the picture of a man, especially if he was a large man at all, sitting on a donkey is about the most unimposing, unimpressive way for a king to enter. I mean, you think about it. All throughout history, Alexander the Great had Bucephalus, the wonderful war horse that he rode for years while he was a teenager and learning from his father, Philip II of Macedon. And as they unite the Greek tribes, he's riding Bucephalus. As he then approaches battle with the Persians, he is riding Bucephalus. He defeats the Persians and goes all the way down into India. And Bucephalus, the war horse, is incredible. While many of the other war horses are facing the battle and they are afraid of the elephants that the Indians used were amazing. They weren't just war elephants, but they had big, like buildings, like rooms on top of them that were filled with archers and people with spears. And the war horses of the Macedonians had never seen or smelled anything like the elephants. And they were scared to death. And then, of course, a war horse has to be able to handle the sound of men dying in battle, the smell of blood. They have to be focused, and Bucephalus was like that, but he was a mighty steed. I remember going into the Louvre at Paris and seeing these huge paintings, one of Napoleon Bonaparte, and he's on this beautiful white war horse. They were impressive, these steeds of kings and mighty warriors, not like the little donkey. See, a king that's going into battle does not ride a donkey. The people are excited because he is here. When he came to the place where the road divides and goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began to joyfully praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. They took their palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel. Some of the Pharisees heard this. They said to the teacher, rebuke your disciples. You see, what these people were doing was pregnant with meaning. Now, throughout the year, each family would set aside a palm branch or palm tree from which they could harvest these lulavs, these branches. And at the beginning of the week, they would be closed. They would be fairly tight. And you'd bundle up a bunch of them, and you could rattle them, and they make quite a nice racket. Kind of when we got thousands of people doing it, it was an amazing sound. Then throughout the week, as the branches begin to branch out a little bit, it's just amazing hearing that sound as well. And they would be used in the festival just before Passover. But the idea that they would wave this lulav, which also was the symbol of the nation of Israel, all of a sudden, the authorities who are under the power of the Romans start to get concerned. They are waving these little flags, and they are crying out to this man on the donkey as though he were a king, and they were threatened. "Watch it," they said. "Don't let them do this. Your disciples are out of control. The Romans are right up there on the wall watching us. Rebuke your disciples." And Jesus says, "I'm telling you the truth. If they keep quiet, the very stones will cry out." Now, St. John tells us more. He says that the crowd that was with him, with Jesus, when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead the previous week, continued to spread the word about that great miracle. Jesus had come just a few days before and raised Lazarus from the dead, and word had spread everywhere. It was not some little bitty thing done in a corner. It was an incredible miracle done in front of hundreds of people, skeptics and others. And now the word was beginning to spread. Now, because they had heard that he had done this miraculous sign, many people went out to meet him. The city of Jerusalem was choked with all kinds of travelers because there were three times throughout the year that they were required to go to Jerusalem. Now, in point of fact, at this time in history, late antiquity, most people would go up just one time, and it was during the Passover. And so the city was choked with people. It was hard to find a place to stay. It was hard to find a place to eat the Passover if you're from out of town. The city's economy was just, it would hinge on this one particular event. Some of the people that are in the city hear that Jesus is right out on the other side of the hill, and they can look across the Kidron Valley, and they can see that, yes, there is a crowd, and something's happening. Come on, let's go. Bring your lulav, because we hear the sound of them waving it from across the valley. And so they went out to meet him. The Pharisees looked at it, and they said, "Listen, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone out after him." They said, "We feel like we're trying to put our finger in the dike and the thing is getting ready to burst over us. It is absolutely out of control." Why are some people cheering and other people are not? And why are some of the people who are not cheering flat out angry? Well, there were several groups here. First of all, there was the group of the disciples. Those were the people who had left everything and were following him. Remember, there were James and John, and there were three of them that were with Jesus all the time. Then there was another group of 12, but then there were also a larger group, because we know at one point Jesus sent out the 70 or the 72. He sent them out to do ministry. We also know that there was a group of women who went along with them. And it was these women, many of whom were married to wealthy unbelievers, but they had their own income, and it was from the income of these benevolent women that they actually were able to live. Jesus received offerings from these women. These women took care of things. These women helped with so many different things. And I would call them disciples as well. So the group of disciples may have been 150, maybe 200. We also know that these were the people that not only had left everything to follow him, but they also knew that he was the Messiah. Then there was the large crowd. These are not the disciples, but they're a large crowd of mostly Jews who are gathered for the festival. Some want to see a miracle. Some are curious. Some really are expectantly waiting for the Messiah. And some are probably believers in Jesus. They're in town for the Passover. They heard about everything. They also wanted to see Lazarus. If you heard about a guy that raised another guy from the dead, flat out raised him from the dead, you would want to be able to talk to that previously dead guy, wouldn't you? You would want to hear what he experienced. There's a pastor friend of mine over in Illinois. He just went to be with the Lord recently, but years ago he had this church. And this guy was not a well-educated guy, but he was excellent at promoting the church for Jesus, and he had a good heart. And he would put these ridiculous commercials on TV of him riding a tricycle, big guy riding a tricycle like mad, going real fast, and then he would fall over on the trike, and they would say, "Where are you going? What are you doing?" And he says, "It's worth a drive for a church that's alive." That's what his church was known for. It was as cornpone as it gets. But his church was filled with people. One day, he called me. It was on a Monday. I said, "What's up, BG?" He says, "Man," he says, "you got to pray with me. I got to go make a visit to the hospital." I said, "What's up?" He said, "Oh, we had a day yesterday you cannot believe." I said, "Weren't you having that evangelist?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, that was good. That was really good." But he says, in the third service, And he liked altar times the way I do, so they always had altar times. He says, in third service, had a bunch of people up here praying, and I saw a crowd in the back. And they're all in a circle, and they're just not paying attention. They're actually making a kind of a disturbance. And I sent one of my staff to go back there, and he got sucked in. He wouldn't stop it. And so finally, I went back there. And he said, I walked up and parted the crowd, and I looked in, and there was one of our old-timers, Charlie. He was laying there, and he was gray, and he was flat out on his back. And I said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Charlie is dead." There was a person down there holding his arm. He tried to get his pulse, and there was no pulse. And there's a lady who says, "Look out, I'm a nurse. I can help." And she starts to do the CPR things. And he said, "I don't know what got into me." He said, "I was embarrassed. I was freaked out." And there was my friend Charlie. And I said, "No, in Jesus' name, Charlie, wake up." I said, "What happened?" He goes, "Charlie woke up." I said, "He did?" He goes, "Yes. He was dead, and then he was awake." And I said, "What happened next?" He said he was very embarrassed because he had lost control like dead people do. And he wanted to get up and go home and change his clothes. We said, "No, you got to go in the ambulance." He goes, "Why? I'm fine." They said, "You were dead, and you freaked us all out. You are not going home. You're going in the ambulance." And they sent him to the hospital. And so he says, "Today is Monday, and I got to go visit him. And I'm afraid to call the hospital because he might be dead." He goes, "Pray with me." Everybody wanted to talk to Charlie. He was alive when BG went in. He lived for quite a while after that. And then he had a natural death. Same thing was true with Lazarus. Everybody would look at him and go, "Man, that dude was dead. And this guy, his buddy, is the one who raised him." They wanted to see what was going on. Others, I believe, were probably sick. There were people who were supposed to stay out of the big crowd. There were people who were supposed to stay off to the side. But they couldn't resist. And like the woman with the issue of blood who was not supposed to be near holy people because her blood made her unclean, they would sneak in and they would touch the edge of Jesus' robe and possibly get healed. If it happened once, why wouldn't it happen again? And so you had these kinds of things happening. Some, no doubt, were standing there with the lulav, being very happy and excited today, But next week, when Jesus fails to kick out the Romans, when he fails to do what they expect him to do, they will be the very same ones that will be crying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And so the big crowd is filled with people that could go either way. And then there were the scribes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. Now, the scribes were not just writers. They also were professional attorneys. Moses, in the year 1250 BC, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, Moses received an incredible vision from the Lord, and he wrote the books. The first five books of the Bible, I believe, were written by Moses. And in them, two of the books primarily deal with how God wanted the people to live under what's called a theocracy. And there are all kinds of laws in there. These guys were experts in those laws. But they hadn't just left the laws alone. They had added on top of the laws. If the law said don't go within 100 feet of somebody who was unclean, they would add a law that says, just to be sure, don't go within 500 feet of that person. They would intensify it. They brought up all kinds of issues. In fact, there was one point where a man came up to Jesus and he says, "What do I do if I want to have a divorce and my wife doesn't please me anymore? Can I just take another wife? Under what circumstances can I take a second wife?" Jesus says, Moses actually wrote into his laws an allowance for you to have multiple wives, but it was because of the hardness of the hearts of your fathers. It was because of their wickedness and their obstinance. God the Father, from the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, said one man, one wife. And then keep in mind that he was talking to a crowd of men who had even distorted what Moses had written to the extent that when the woman who was caught in adultery is brought before Jesus, the man that she was messing around with is untouched. Why? Because the rabbis had made it legal for him and fatally illegal for her. That's what they had done with these laws. They had so messed them up. These were people that used detail to entrap people. And then the Pharisees were the ones that kept track of the problems. And the Sadducees didn't even believe in a resurrection, but they were the political leaders. They all decided that Jesus had to go. They wanted to kill him, but at the right time, under the right circumstances, because they said he's not only dangerous, but his leadership is inconvenient. He simply does not fit the criteria of a Messiah. First of all, Jesus was from the wrong side of the tracks. He came from the wrong state. The Messiah had been foretold that he had to come from the state called Judea. And in the state of Judea are all these cities, and there's one city called the House of Bread, Beit Lechem, Bethlehem. And that's where he will come from. It was the city of David, because David was a type of the Messiah. He was a forerunner of the Messiah, and he was going to be related to this Messiah. And so there are all these rules. And Jesus, according to their understanding, came from another state. He came from Galilee. Now, if they had done their homework, they would have discovered that not only was Jesus born in Bethlehem, but he came from descendants of David as well. He fit all the criteria. But see, the Lord had him grow up as a young man and a teenager in a northern state called Galilee, in a city called Nazareth. And so they didn't even think that he fit that criteria. Plus the fact that he was poor. How could a king come from somebody who was poor? His father did not have a profession. They had all kinds of great rabbis. They had the house of Hillel. They had the house of Shammai. And they had all kinds of young scholars that were sons of the Pharisees, sons of the rabbis. They grew up being educated and prepared and trained to rule. Who was this man? This Jesus. There were questions about the legitimacy of his birth, his conception. And his father worked with his hands. He barely made enough to keep body and soul together. Up there in the north, his father had to go on a circuit from one city to another city to another city, doing carpentry work, fixing leather goods as well, making pots and pans. This is the kind of thing that he did. There was no prestige in what he did at all. And this was his son. Now, the guy didn't have an education as far as they were concerned. He hadn't been to any of their schools. But you know what? We know that he could read and write because he uses the stick to write in the soil. In chapter 7, verse 53 to 8:12, he is writing epigrapho. He's not just drawing circles, he is writing. He knew how to read, he knew how to write, and guess what? He was brilliant. He knew things that the scribes didn't know. He knew loopholes that they had never even dreamed up. And they tried their best to entrap him. They even brought in the hired guns, the best of the best. And they would be positioned in the crowd. And at just the right time, they would ask Jesus this incredible question and try to trap him. And he turned it on them every time. And when it didn't work with theological questions, they tried to get him with political stuff. He was also rude to the leaders. These were the guys that were looking out for the Messiah. They were watching. This Messiah had to fit these criteria. And they were the ones that kept false messiahs from having any kind of credibility. He didn't wear the special uniforms they wore. He didn't act like them. He didn't show any gratitude to them. In fact, every time they came together and they started quizzing him, he was rude to them. One time, instead of respecting them and bowing down like everybody else when these big shots came in, Jesus said, "You look good on the outside, but on the inside, you're full of rotting corpses." Can you imagine saying that to President Obama? "You look good on the outside, but on the inside, you're full of rotting corpses." That is not going to win friends and influence people. It is not. That's what he said. There were other times that he said, "Oh, yeah, you and your rules." He said, "You make a milkshake, and when you get ready to drink it, you gag at a little tiny gnat, but then you swallow a camel." He was too smart for them, and he did miracles that they had never seen before. But this business of coming in to Jerusalem riding on a donkey was too much. It just blew their minds. Because any time a great person came in, they would come in with a phalanx of soldiers first. And then the lictor would come in behind them. And the lictor had this incredible voice. And he would say, "Make way! Make way! Get out of the street! The great and mighty Caesar is coming in behind us." And the Caesar would be borne in on a litter, and he would be surrounded with this Praetorian bodyguard. Juvenal, writing about one generation after the time of Jesus, says this: "Here in Rome, the rich man will be carried above the heads of the crowd, the street, by his tall Ligurian litter bearers. As people give way, he will be swiftly transported to his destination. While inside the litter, he will read or write or sleep. For a litter with the windows closed induces sleep. Without any personal strain, the big shot will arrive before us, whereas we, although we're in a hurry, are blocked by a wave of humanity in front of us, and the great crowds behind us crush us. One man hits me with his elbow. Another knocks me with a hard pole. One man strikes me on the head with a wooden beam, and I get bumped on the head with a wine jar from another. My legs are covered with thick mud by the time I arrive at my destination. Then on all sides, big feet step on me, and a nail from some soldier's boot pierces my toe. The wagons are terrible, he says. One wagon carries fir wood timber, another carries pine. They are piled so dangerously high, and they sway, posing for the crowd an imminent threat of danger. For if a wagon carrying a marble should hit a pothole, it might tip over and dump its load of mountain rock on top of the throng of people. What would remain of the bodies? Who would find the limbs or the bones? The crushed body would utterly disappear like the soul. How you traveled back then told everybody what they needed to know about your status. And him coming in on a donkey not only was offensive to them, but it did not fit their categories. But he did it purposely, because a king coming in on a donkey is not like a guy, a warrior coming in on Bucephalus. It's not at all like that. 750 years before, the prophet Zechariah had written this: "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. Look, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." He came that time gentle. He made every signal that his kingdom was not about politics and about armies and about might. It was about people's hearts. But that guy that came as a baby and rode on that little colt is coming back as the king of the universe. And he comes at the head of an army of redeemed souls and angels. When he comes back the next time, what group will you be in? Will you be in the crowd? Will you be in the crowd of the distracted? Do you spend all of your time pursuing the wrong things, looking for happiness in a job? Or is your job just a means to an end, like it should be? Are you looking for relationships for happiness? Are you looking for buying a new thing for happiness? Are you looking to drugs? Are you looking to sex? Are you looking to any of that stuff? I think that because you're here, there's a good chance that you have your ladder against the right wall. You will probably come back as part of the army of our mighty King. Let's pray.